This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yehiz Wuhib, and coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight...
Ethiopian human rights activists, members of opposition parties, and those working in the media say their freedom of movement has been severely limited since the government declared a state of emergency 3 weeks ago. Many are afraid to speak out, while others had to stop working.
That's Martha Vanderwolf reporting from Addis Ababa. Details coming up.
Also, Kenyan authorities are systematically curtailing civil liberties by targeting defenders of civil rights, according to a new report. And the Libyan Navy says about 90 migrants died yesterday when their raft started sinking 26 miles off the coast of west of Tripoli.
We'll have these stories and lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight.
Our top story this hour, a new report says Kenyan authorities are systematically curtailing civil liberties by targeting defenders of civil rights. The authors of the report are concerned about the impact the trend might have on Kenya's 2017 elections. Lenny Ruvaga reports from Nairobi.
Rights activists have complained for years about alleged extrajudicial killings by Kenyan police. Criticism intensified after the killings this June of human rights lawyer Willie Kimani, his client, and their driver. The new report on civil liberties is the result of a fact-finding mission by an umbrella group, the World Organization Against Torture. Benson Olugbo was a mission delegate and is executive director of the Clean Foundation, an organization that agitates for what it calls accessible justice. Speaking to reporters in Nairobi Friday, Olugbo said Kenya needs police and judiciary reform if the country's civil liberties are to remain intact.
So we are asking for police reform, which is sustained, because it's not a day's business, it's a process. We're also asking that agencies that are independent should also be allowed to work, and that where there are grievances, people should have that right to go to court, to go to police to report, and that the respect of Kenyan citizens, the right actually also, to demonstrate, which is provided in the Constitution, should be protected.
The new report was compiled after the mission met with the representatives of civil society groups, the police, the judiciary, and the European Union delegation in Kenya. Samuel Mohochi, the executive director at the International Commission of Jurists, ICJ, Kenya chapter, said democratic gains made over the years are slowly being eroded by authorities, and advocates for civil liberties are being silenced.
I think the increasing or rising levels of intolerance in society, especially for specific duty bearers or actors, would then create a fertile ground for increased intolerance to criticisms, and that in itself is a clawback to democratic gains. And it starts slowly. Before you realize it, you're in a police state. So these are things that should be flagged at the earliest opportune moment.
The Kenya National Commission on Human Rights, KNCHR, is an autonomous public body charged with redressing human rights violations. Commission Chairperson Kagwiri Mbogori says that in the past year, KNCHR has presented 81 cases of forced disappearances to the Inspector General, the Attorney General's Office, and the Director of Public Prosecutions for action. Mbogori says that proving who is behind the disappearances is becoming extremely hard.
The act of disappearance can be explained in a number of ways. It may be some people have been killed and their bodies have never been found, but it is impossible to really narrow down and point a finger to a particular culprit or culprits. This is very, very saddening, and right now we are dealing with citizens who have encountered this, and it is very harrowing. It is worse than death, because you don't know whether your loved one has died, or whether they are somewhere suffering, or where they went, etc. The uncertainty is terrible.
The World Organization Against Torture says the elections slated for 2017 could prove fatal if the trend of silencing civil society continues unabated. Around 1,100 people were killed in violence after the 2007 elections, with another 600,000 being displaced. Next year's vote is scheduled for August. New members of Kenya's Electoral Commission are set to take office this December. Lenny Rovaga for VOA News, Nairobi.
Ethiopian human rights activists, members of the opposition parties, and those working in the media say their freedom of movement has been severely limited since the government declared a state of emergency 3 weeks ago. Many are afraid to speak out, while others had to stop working. Martha van der Wolf reports from Addis Ababa.
Ethiopia's government has insisted the six-month state of emergency, declared so authorities can deal with protests in the Oromia and Amhara regions, does not affect the constitutional rights of citizens. But while things might seem calm in the streets of Addis Ababa, those perceived as challenging the government's view say they are often blocked from carrying out their activities. Asafa Habtewold is the chairman of the opposition All Ethiopian Unity Party. He says it has become almost impossible for his party members to operate.
We cannot go from region to region and visit our members. We cannot conduct meetings with our members at different districts. All this is prohibited. All in all, we cannot make a meeting of more than 2 persons. Totally, our movement is halted. Until the end of the state of emergency, we cannot do anything.
The party, like other opposition parties, says dozens of its members have been detained or are being harassed. Addi Standard, a weekly independent magazine, announced last week it is suspending its print edition. No printing house is willing to print their magazine following the state of emergency, says editor-in-chief Tsedala Lema.
It makes everybody hang on to this unspecified fear of what's going to happen if, you know, this material is published. Will it be misunderstood? Will it be used against me? And so this has a huge impact on doing journalism for us. And as we have seen it now with Addis Standard, it even extends to vendors and printers and pretty much everyone involved in making a print product.
Tsedala says the magazine will continue online despite the country's internet being mostly switched off. Ethiopia's largest ethnic group, the Oromo, has been demonstrating for nearly a year, demanding more freedom, economic inclusiveness, and proper compensation for land disputes. Hundreds have been killed during clashes with police. Marta van der Wolf for VOA News, Addis Ababa.
The Libyan Navy says about 90 migrants died yesterday when their large rubber raft started sinking 26 miles off the coast west of Tripoli. A spokesman told the AP that 29 people were rescued, most of them were Africans. In a separate incident, the medical aid group Doctors Without Borders says its vessel recovered the bodies of 25 migrants on an overcrowded inflatable raft in the Mediterranean. This year's death toll for migrants in the Mediterranean is now more than 3,800, making 2016 the deadliest year ever for migrants at sea.
In other related news, dozens of unaccompanied minors slept overnight in a makeshift school in what remains of the disbanded camp in Calais, France. The children had missed the required deadline yesterday for registration to leave the camp called the Jungle. Today, they and remaining adults are said to have been taken for resettlement in other parts of France. Valentine Bollenbach is a spokesperson for Save the Children in Calais. VOA's William Eagle asked her for an update on the situation.
Yesterday afternoon, the registration for minors, anybody under the age of 18 to register, was shut. So this left approximately 60 other agencies are reporting up to 100 children who had literally nowhere to go. The jungle was on fire, the registration was shut, and the temporary accommodation was full. Unfortunately, some of these children did have to sleep outside under bridges and on the side of the road, and this is just absolutely unacceptable. I was sitting with two boys from Afghanistan, one who was 15 and one who was 16. Both told me that they slept on the side of the road with a thin blanket and that they were absolutely freezing and petrified to go back to the jungle. I truly believe that the jungle has never been more dangerous as it has been in the last 48 hours. And it's just unreal that children here in France, in Europe, are forced to sleep on the side of the road and have no other option, no one to protect them.
How many children remain? And as of today, are authorities taking care of them, seeing that they've been registered?
As of last night, we were standing outside of the jungle camp, which at this point, for the most part, had been destroyed. And there were still about 30 or 40 unaccompanied children. Now, this is incredibly worrying because the night before, we knew of many more. And what we had been concerned about since the beginning of all of this, without having the right kind of information and communication in place, is that children would, in fact, go missing. When children feel that the system has failed them or neglected them, they decide to take matters into their own hands. And this is so worrying. They're exposing themselves to numerous risks, falling at the hands of smugglers and traffickers. And of course, there are people who are willing to exploit this situation, unfortunately. And last night, whilst we waited in the cold for about 6 hours, finally, the part of the camp that had not been demolished opened up, and people were able to sleep for one night in the school and in the mosque that was left there. Now, today, I've just heard from my colleague, who's actually down there at the moment, that buses have come, and the remaining people will hopefully be leaving today.
Does this mean that they have all been registered and they will be on their way to either other parts of France or to the UK?
Unfortunately, as most things have been throughout this week, there's a huge lack of communication and very little information. So I'm unable to confirm if, in fact, people are going to be put on buses to France or to the UK. At least we know now that hopefully tonight nobody will be sleeping rough who is left at the jungle camp in Calais. But what is concerning is that even if these children are being put on buses, are they being told where they're going? Is there a translator there to explain this to them? They've been through such traumatic and distressing journeys, coming from their countries of origin, making these incredibly harrowing journeys alone through the Mediterranean Sea, through Europe by themselves, and now not even being sure, not even being told where they're going to end up. We know that last year, more than 10,000 children went missing once they arrived in Europe. How many more children will have to go missing after this situation in Calais?
Are you confident that by the end of the day today, when evening falls, that everyone from the camp, including the children, will have found a place to stay? Or is it likely that some may remain in so-called container camps?
I really hope that by the end of today, all of the children will be sleeping in a safe place. This is something that Save the Children has been calling for from the beginning of the demolition, that all children be put at the forefront of this operation. Children need a safe place to sleep. They need to be protected at times like this.
That was Valentina Bollenbach of Save the Children in Calais, France. She was speaking with VOA's William Eagle.
You're listening to Africa News Tonight live on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
I'm Yehiz Wuhib, 18 past the hour. Here's a recap of our top stories. Kenyan authorities are systematically curtailing civil liberties by targeting defenders of civil rights, according to a new report. And the movement of human rights activists, opposition groups, and journalists have been severely limited since the Ethiopian government declared a state of emergency 3 weeks ago. And for more news and information, visit our website at voaafrica.com.
A unique financial model is making education for children from low-income families in Uganda a reality. The new type of school loan replaces the non-traditional one-size-fits-all financial program. The new model can be tailor-made to meet the specific educational needs of any local community while helping family businesses to keep a constant cash flow. The global nonprofit Opportunity International helps people in developing nations to work their way out of poverty. It is also a micro-lender that has expanded its loan portfolio from small business and agriculture loans to small education loans. These loans are provided at the local level to help children attend school and stay in school. Nathan Bird is head of education finance for Opportunity International. He explains their model helps to break down barriers such as illiteracy and geographic isolation.
Essentially, we build long-term partnerships with organizations and corporations like Caterpillar, for example, who's been supporting us since 1994, where they entrust us with resources and we build engines of economic development. For example, in early stage education finance, Caterpillar and the MasterCard Foundation, for example, really trusted us to build concepts via strong research and development by getting close to our clients with a 99% local staffing ratio, spending time working to understand problems rather than just throwing standard banking products out the door, really focusing on human-centered design for a bank.
Recent statistics from UNESCO show that there are presently 260 million children who are not in school at the primary and secondary levels. Bird says that's unfortunate because education is the most powerful tool to break the cycle of poverty.
When a child drops out of school, it's really not just a cycle of poverty, it's a downward spiral because the entire world is moving forward without them. And we often hear things like girls are the first to be removed from school when finances suffer. And really, that's just a symptom. What we're working to do is to confront and abolish the real causes for child-level dropout from education and non-enrollment in the first place.
Bird says Opportunity International has uncovered some of the real causes of children dropping out of school. These causes include schools being too expensive, schools being too far away, the curriculum may not meet the needs for local employment, or just poor quality education. In addition, students also have to deal with health issues such as HIV/AIDS, cholera, malaria, and high incidences of workplace accidents.
We are designing financial products in a human-centered fashion for schools and for families and for students to ensure that these off-ramps on the road to educational completion don't sidetrack them. We're investing in schools and we're ensuring that schools can scale to meet the demand in their local community and can get every child in their community into school so that they have an option to pursue an education. And I probably don't have to tell you or your audience that you don't have to convince a parent in sub-Saharan Africa more broadly or Uganda specifically that an education is the way forward for their children.
Bird emphasizes that school fee loans empower families by allowing them to protect their productive assets and grow their business as well.
At the same time, ensuring that their child doesn't have to miss a day of school because of inconsistent cash flows. Absenteeism is hands down the number one indicator of dropout. And if we can reduce absenteeism and ensure that children are in school every day, rather than just the days that mom and dad have cash in hand, we can ensure a brighter future for sub-Saharan Africa and Uganda more specifically.
Opportunity International recently announced that it received a $1 million grant to expand its education finance initiatives in Uganda and other countries from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. Bird says the project will build the first set of automated credit models to help millions more low-income families to send their children to school. Kim Lewis, VOA News, Washington.
The World Health Organization says last year almost 6 million children under the age of 5 died. Some of those deaths are caused by diarrhea and the lack of proper sanitation. Children in sub-Saharan Africa are more than 14 times more likely to die before the age of 5 than children in developed regions. A new report published in the journal PLOS ONE on Wednesday argues that access to latrines is a major hurdle to reducing child mortality. VOA's David Arnold has the story.
More than half of all deaths of children under the age of 5 are due to diseases that are preventable and treatable through simple, affordable interventions. The World Health Organization says strengthening health systems to provide such interventions will save many lives. Professor Paul Hunter of Norwich Medical School of East Anglia University in England was a co-author of the study, along with a colleague from WHO in Geneva. Their research examined dozens of previous studies of global, national, and field-based research that traced the relationship between child health and access to latrines. The study focused on lack of proper sanitation and the availability of toilets as a major factor in reducing child deaths due to diarrhea. They found that while in past decades child mortality in less developed countries dropped, death rates remain much higher than the 10 per thousand in Europe and North America. Hunter talked about the part of the world where lack of access to latrines is the most prevalent.
The biggest area that has failed to progress as well as the rest of the planet has been sub-Saharan Africa. That remains a big, big issue. I think that's the area that lags most behind in terms of achieving what was the last Millennium Development Goals and possibly will with the new Sustainable Development Goals.
Hunter says the assumption was that an increase in the number of latrines in a community or a country would lower the rate of diarrheal deaths. He says the numbers around the globe were disappointing because you had to have a higher threshold of access.
If you spend a lot of money improving coverage from, say, 20% of the population to 60% of the population, you're still unlikely to see any health benefits from that.
Hunter says the reason for that failure is simple. One family's access to a latrine will not affect their health risks because they live in a community that shares those risks.
Whether you have a toilet or not doesn't really reduce your risk from getting diarrheal disease or your own children, in fact, dying from diarrheal disease. What it does is protects your neighbor. Clearly, if your children are excreting disease-causing organisms in their stool, then you've got a latrine or you've got a toilet. Your children's feces are kept out of the environment. But if your neighbor's children are just defecating in the open, then you are still at risk from your neighbor, even though you have a latrine yourself.
Health risks that can be reduced by proper sanitation are not solved by individuals, but by communities. Hunter's argument is that you must see that everyone in a community has easy access to toilets and is willing to use them.
For me, one of the big lessons is that actually if you're going to do sanitation, it's probably best to try and do it well in each location before you move on. If you can provide 1,000 toilets, it's probably best to go for a small area where you get 100% coverage and then move on to somewhere else rather than saying, okay, well, you know, I'll spread it out. We'll increase coverage to about 40% across a large number of villages, whereas we can achieve 100% coverage over a smaller range of villages. And I think from the health point of view, I think it's better to achieve 100% before you move on to try and improve it elsewhere.
Even with access, Hunter acknowledges some people who are accustomed to defecating along a roadside will find that a latrine smells bad. That culture must change in order to lower the rates at which children in Africa and in many other parts of the world die from diarrheal disease. But first, they need equal access to latrines. David Arnold, VOA, Washington.
And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com.
For listeners on VOA's Nairobi FM station, please stay tuned for the Swahili Evening News coming up at 16:30 UTC.
For all other listeners, please stay tuned to The Sunny Side of Sports. Tune in again at 1800 UTC for another edition of Africa News Tonight. On behalf of our producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Peter Hundley, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
When news breaks, VOA Africa is there. On weekends, tune into Nightline Africa at 1600 and 1800 UTC. And our 5-minute newscasts come to you at the top of each hour. VOA Africa, your trusted source of information.
On November 8th, American citizens will exercise their right to vote and choose their next president. VOA is providing comprehensive coverage of this unique democratic process. Who is going to earn the trust of the American people to lead the nation for the next 4 years? Find out right here on VOA.
Music time in Africa. Savor the flavor of African music. Hi, I'm Heather Maxwell, host of Music Time in Africa. Tune in, feast your ears, and dig in to an hour of amazing Pan-African music, featured interviews, and music news. Music Time in Africa, Friday at 0900 and Saturday and Sunday at 0900, 15, 20, and 2200 hours UTC.